WFNI, 93 WIBC, HD2, Indianapolis.
Hey, Jay,
from the racing capital of the world. This is the talk of Gasoline Alley.
For Alan Sir, winner of the...
Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
John Cox wins it by less than one-tenth of a second.
Now, here's the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee.
It's not the month of May, but we found an opportunity, an excuse to bring Donald in some more. Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley, the July edition, getting you set for the Brickyard 400 coming up this weekend with NASCAR Sprint Cup, NASCAR Nationwide, and the Tudor Sports Car Championship as well with IMSA, and actually likely more. Continental Tires, the Continental Tire Series might be racing. I have to look this up. This will be part of my prep, but I'm still just back into the country, Donald. I haven't started moving over and shifting towards the weekend. Tonight on Trackside, we talked nothing but IndyCar. We'll
back
move forward.
Just back into the country.
They let me back in. I was always...
How far is it over the border? 60 miles or something like that?
Yeah, but you still got to go through some hoops, and there's some paperwork involved. Still some paperwork involved to do that. It just... Canada has always felt like we should be chummy. I'm not sure why we need all this paperwork to go between America and Canada, but that's how it works, and somebody's probably monetizing that, so... Welcome. It's great to see you.
Thank you, Kevin.
We'll take telephone calls of a historical nature, so fair game. Anything is fair game relating to the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Sure.
It doesn't have to be just NASCAR related, but that always works if you can think of a link to IMS. How are you on your Brickyard 400 trivia?
Not so hot. I mean, probably better on USAC stock cars or AAA stock cars in the 50s and 60s and the 70s, perhaps.
But. Okay, we're going to roll through a few phone calls, and then I do want Donald to speak on Gary Lee, who we lost very surprisingly this past week, the longtime motorsports broadcaster and a longtime part of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network and ESPN. And also Jim Garner, we just learned about yesterday. So we will do that coming up in just a few minutes. But we start, and it's a new phone system, so wish me well.
Oh.
First time I'm taking a telephone call. Donald in Richmond, Virginia. Hello, Donald. Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Donald.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Donald.
How are you?
I'm doing well. I've come up with probably one of the best stock car drivers of his era, but there's an Indianapolis 500 link. I'd like you to talk about Red Byron tonight.
Okay. Red Byron was the NASCAR champ. Was he the first NASCAR champion in 1949? And I think he was like the modified champion the year before that, I think. But he was from Atlanta, but I think he was born in Chicago. And his ambition was actually the Indianapolis 500, and he did drive in some sprint car races, or what we now call sprint car races. They didn't call it that then. And he had a dryer single-seater, which he ran mostly in the southern states whenever AAA ran sprint cars down in Savannah, Georgia, and Richmond, Virginia, and a few places like that. But I know that he did run some in the Midwest. There was a race at the very first race at Powell Speedway, just north of Columbus, Ohio, was a race right after the 1946 500, and I know he was in that one. But anyway, about Indianapolis, Red Byron was entered for the 500 in 47, and 48, and there's a story out there. In fact, you ran this one by me, and I raised an eyebrow, because apparently there's a suggestion that he was at the Speedway making a qualifying attempt and was hit by a bird, or hit a bird, or whatever. Other people have had that happen, but if it happened to him, I had not heard that. But it would not have been on a qualifying attempt, because he did not complete a driver's test. And he was there in 47 and 48 with the Parks Vote Special, which was Raymond Parks and Red Vote, who are better known as stock car people, early NASCAR pioneers, as is Red Byron. But they were here with a car, 47 and 48. and the incomplete rookie test or driver's test, familiarization test, whatever you want to call it, was 47. And then in 48, I'm not sure if he just briefly practiced or didn't get on the track or what. But anyway, that was it as far as the 500 was concerned. But in the meantime, NASCAR was brand new and getting going. And I believe he was the first champ in 49. You could straighten me out on that one because you know more about those things than I do.
Thank you, Donald.
Thank you. Good to
Appreciate it.
You.
All right.
Dave in Lafayette, Indiana is up next on 1070 The Fan and FM 107.5 from our drivehubler.com studios with Donald Davidson.
Okay, David, how are you?
Pretty good, Donald. How are you?
Wiser. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, listen, my son and I had some fun with you and Johnny Parsons at Coyote Crossing about 3 years ago in Lafayette, Indiana, the golf course.
Uh-huh.
And had a time. But listen, hey, I just read.
Uh-oh, did we lose?
I think we just...
I didn't do it.
It wasn't me.
I didn't touch anything.
It's this new phone system. What's wrong with what we had?
There was a lot wrong with what we had.
Oh, all right, then.
Yeah, there was.
There's no patient game tonight,
I've got caller ID now.
All right, then.
Yeah.
Can we call him back?
Well, no, he's disconnected already.
All right,
I didn't
then.
Write it down. All right, call us back. There's still open lines at 239-1070. And Tom, in one of my former homes, Muncie, Indiana, joins us now.
Hello, Donald.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. This is a non-stock car question.
Okay.
It has to do with Tony Hallman. Understand that when he would ride in the pace car, he would usually have a movie camera to take home movies. Did he ever make any of those movies like available for like public viewing?
I don't think that's true. What happened was a camera was placed in the trunk. And the first time I off the pace car, I think the earliest I know of this was 1950, and I think that might have been either the newsreel people or MGM, and then a little bit later on with Dynamic Films, Nathan Zucker, and also Championship Race Films with Fred Bailey, they would put a camera in the trunk with a hole cut so that the lens could poke out.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony Hallman had the job of hitting the button when he thought it was, there was a good lineup behind him so that you wouldn't waste film, because typically you'd only have 100 feet of film, I think, was 2 minutes and 45 seconds or something of my... film memories not letting me down there. And so I think they were supposed to get the cars properly lined up, and then normally Sam Hanks would be driving the pace car, or at least not in 1950 he wasn't, because he was driving in the race, but in the from 58 through 63 Sam Hanks drove the pace car, and Tony would ride shotgun or with his knees on the passenger seat looking out the back, and then his job was to press the button when he thought they were lined up properly so he could get a couple of minutes worth of footage. So I think that's where that come from. The way that you stated it, the impression is that he was standing there with a handheld camera, and I don't think that he ever, I'm sure he never did that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to picture. But that's pretty interesting, though.
Okay, but I don't know, and you wait until the people that can answer the question and around, and then you start asking the questions. In 1950, in To Please a Lady, which was an MGM film, there's a gorgeous shot during the pace lap of looking out the back with the front row coming towards you, which we take for granted now because it's, with the TV camera cars. But in those days, that was heavy-duty stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if Tony Hallman had the job of pressing the button that year. Benson Ford was the pace car driver, but it may well have been that Tony was entrusted into, pressing the button to start the camera.
Hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Tom. Dave is back with us now, I think. Is this you, Dave?
Yeah, I'm back.
Let's give it another go.
Hey, Donald, hey, I just want to tell you, my son and I hung out with you and Johnny Parsons at 2011 on Coyote Crossing Golf Course in Lafayette. Had a blast with you.
Oh, I remember being up there. Yes, at the country club, I think it was.
God, I wish we'd do it again. But anyway, hey, I just want to applaud you for your input on the book on the Black Sunday, the 1964 500. I just got done reading it. It was awesome.
Okay, great.
Black Noon.
I haven't read the book, and as many of my friends will tell you, I was very, very concerned when I learned that that project was in the works, even a couple of years ago. And as and I was thinking, well, maybe nothing will come of it. But when I realized something was coming of it, and it was going to be a book about the 1964 500, I thought, oh, my goodness me, we're going to have Blood and Smoke, the modern version. And I was greatly concerned about it. And I've probably had 24 to 30 people say that they've read it. And everybody says it's excellent. So apparently my fears were unfounded or unnecessary or whatever. But I still haven't seen the book.
Someday I'm going to have some time to read books again instead of just the stuff on the internet that I have to read. But I've read... I read about the first 35 pages or so, and I like what I've seen so
far. Okay, well,
so
I hear it's
that and
good.
Beast are my next two that I'm going to read.
I have Beast, and I haven't read
when
that.
When I get some time off, which is going to be, I think, in... Well, I'm not sure. I'm
okay.
Not sure. next up with us is, and thank you for the call, Don, Jerry in Frankfort, Indiana. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Hey, how y'all doing tonight?
Hi, thank you.
This is an IndyCar question. What could you tell me about Roscoe Sorrells?
Roscoe Sorrells ran in the 500 four times, 1919 through 1922. He was from Lafayette as an adult and when he was racing, but he was born in the southern part of the state, and I'm searching my brain now. I think he was born down in New Albany or somewhere down in the Louisville area, but... At some point, they moved to Lafayette. I think his dad worked for the railroad, and that was why he was there. But that's where he was when he got started in racing, and he went to Lafayette Jeff High School, as did George Souders, who won the race in 27, and also Steve Hannigan, who was the track's PR man. They all went to the same high school. And Roscoe Sorrells, as far as the 500 is concerned, as they say, he ran four times. The highlight would be 1921 when he was on the Duesenberg team driving for Fred and Augie Duesenberg and finished second behind Tommy Milton. But in 1919, his first start, he drove a car that was actually ran as the Golden Submarine. Barney Oldfield did a lot of demonstrations with it with an enclosed canopy, or you know, with an enclosed cockpit. But running as an open cockpit, Roscoe Sorrells made his debut and ran eight laps and was the first one out. There were 33 starters, so I suppose in the box course he's classified as 33rd position. Although in those days, they only awarded the positions to the cars which were finished or running at the end. But anyway, 33rd by modern standards. And then in 1920, he was on the Chevrolet team, the Chevrolet Brothers team, with the Monroe and the Frontenac specials, and did not finish. And then drove for Duesenberg, as they say, in 21 and got second. And then in 22, he was back with the Chevrolet Brothers, but he drove for Cliff Durant at Kansas City on a date that escapes me. Was it September the 17th, I think, of 1922? A board track, wooden plank, super speedway made out of wood. And there was a terrible accident. He was fatally injured. It was a really horrible accident. But anyway, he was, I suppose, considered a local driver. And I'm not too sure if there might be still Sorrells family members living up in the Lafayette area. I've heard that there are. None of them have ever come forth. But one of those drivers that, in fact, there's a book supposedly coming out fairly soon. It's been in the works for quite some time called Second to None. And it's a profile on every driver who finished second and didn't win.
Oh, wow.
And so he would be one of the early drivers featured in that book.
So they're calling Scott Goodyear a lot.
Yes, yeah. It's funny, as the book has gone along, there have been those, like, for instance, Tony Kanaan was in the book for several years, and then
he
won it, so I have to take him out of there.
Well, good for TK. All right, thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Joe in New Palestine. I always hear it differently. How do you pronounce it, Joe?
I say New Palestine. Kevin, Donald, thanks for taking my call.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
239-1070, by the way, is the number, and we have open phone lines. Yeah. Go ahead, Joe.
In honor of this week's race, Donald, can you talk about how the track got its nickname of the Brickyard and whose idea it was to leave the yard of bricks at the start-finish line?
Well, I couldn't answer the second part, but the first part is it's one of those things that just evolved, and apparently the locals gave it the name. And it's because when the track opened in the summer of 1909, the original surface was crushed rock and tar, which sounds terrible, and it was terrible, but largely because paving was brand new. And there was Carl Fisher was already taking the state to task because there was no money appropriated for the development of roads. And some states were spending money on developing roads, some of the surrounding states, but Indiana did not. And so when they laid the surface down for the track, I'm wondering whether that may have been the first paving job in the state. That's just a personal theory. But anyway, when they ran the motorcycles in August of 1909, it was supposed to be August the 13th and 14th, and that was a disaster. And then automobiles the next week, August 19th, 20th, and 21st, the track kept breaking up. And so both the motorcycles and the automobile races pretty much were disasters in some respects. And so... obviously, the surface was ill-chosen, and so they realized that they would have to do something else. And concrete was discussed and some others, and then finally it was decided that it would be a lot more expensive, but surrounding states were paving streets with bricks, and so they put down a brick surface. What they did was a little bit different in that the bricks were designed to interlock. So when you go to Zionsville and you go to the Circle and other streets where there's bricks, there's no mortar used. The bricks lay face to face to face to face. And when they were putting the speedway surface down, they thought, we need something a little stronger. And so what they did was to put sand on top of the crushed rock and tar, and then they laid the bricks into the sand, but they left about a quarter of an inch on each side. They staggered them in rows, and they would do a section at a time. They'd roll it and make sure that it was nice and flat. And then they would pour the mortar down to give it a strong surface. So there's several reasons for mentioning this. And one is that probably once every week or 10 days, somebody says, I've got a brick that I think was in the speedway. And then I'll say, well, does it have mortar on it? And if it does, then I think you can pretty much take it to the bank that it was out of the track, because I believe that's the only time that mortar was used whenever those bricks were laid down on a road. So the fact that 3,200,000 bricks comprised the entire 2.5 miles, the locals started to call it the Brickyard. And I've had it suggested that it was called that because there was a brickyard on the surface. Well, that's not true. There was no brickyard there. And then the other thing, too, is in retrospect, in defense of the original surface, they were putting the thing together right up until the very last moment. In fact, the people were arriving for practice and they're still doing the surface. So I'm thinking the fact that it was either raining or it was sweltering hot, and what you had was just like this gooey mass of tar and the crushed rock, which was powdered rock. I wonder that if they had a chance to lay the surface down and then let it sit for a few weeks or, you know, a couple of months or so, I wonder if it might have been stronger than it was. But as it was, spinning wheels on sticky tar that sure. hadn't fixed yet was not a happy mix. Yep. And so they said, we made a mistake. We need to put down a new surface. But anyway, the term the brickyard, apparently that was given by either the locals or the media or a combination of both.
Okay, Joe?
Thanks.
Oh, and I didn't answer the second part, which I cannot answer, and that's whose decision was it to leave the yard of bricks? Well, what happened was they began to put asphalt down. Actually, the summer of 1935 is when they started. It was very haphazard at first, and then I think in either 36 or 37 they did the turns from entrance to exit, and then in 38 they did the backstretch. And I don't remember if that was before or after the race, but when you get to like about 1940, everything was blacktop now on top of the bricks. I mean, they didn't take the bricks out. They just put the blacktop down on top of it. But the greater part of the main straightaway, and a couple of engineers have tried to figure out what the length, and it recently came up that it may have been 714 yards. But anyway, approximately 700 yards of the main straightaway was still bricks and mortar coming back from the war, and then all the way up through 1961. Mm-hmm. So when Foyt won for the first time and Brabham was ninth with the rear engine Cooper, the several hundred yards of the main straightaway was still the exposed bricks. So they covered over the bricks, and I'm not sure what they did about the start-finish line, but I rather think but what they've done in the meantime is actually take the bricks up. And they may have done that in 61, rather than just leave the start-finish line exposed. I think what they probably did was to cover over everything and then do an inlay. And certainly that's what they've done in the recent applications, is to put the new surface down complete. And so for a while, there is no start-finish line. And then they come in and then they cut out a trough and then inlay bricks of the same type. And I never thought about this for a while, but in studying photographs that were taken when they dedicated the track in late 61 with Ray Haroon, Tony Holman, and Governor Matthew Welsh, if you look a little closely, I think maybe that's what they did then, and actually cut a trough out and lay the new bricks in.
Now, you say they... And by the way, thank you, Joe. I think we covered everything there. Glad to hear from you.
Thanks.
You say that they always paved over the original bricks,
yeah.
But you hear of all these bricks
yeah.
that are of it. Where are these
yeah.
bricks that people have? And supposedly they have an archive of bricks.
I don't know if they do anymore. They have a supply of the original type, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
There may be, but as far as those that have got mortar stuck on them, that supply may have dried up. Where did they come from? There's two answers to that, and that is one is every time they put in a tunnel, they would take out the section of track, and when they would replace the track, like for instance what is now the main entrance with the mm-hmm. tunnel, all right, that was done between 72-73. If you went down 16th Street in the summer of 1972, there was no racetrack for however many yards it was, as they bulldozed out and put the four lanes in, and then when they replaced the track, they didn't put the bricks back in. And there are six tunnels.
Okay, They
got a bunch of bricks then. So whenever you go over, if you're going over a tunnel, there's no bricks there. But if you're not over a tunnel, they are there. The other part is that there used to be a steeper outer bank. And in the turns, we're told it's 9 degrees and 12 minutes banking. And actually, I'm not sure how that's figured, because it is parabolic. It's not a steady incline like Dover. It's parabolic. And so the further up the bank you go, the steeper it's going to get. So I'm assuming the 9 degrees and 12 minutes is the average. However, there used to be, in the turns, a steeper outer banking. And that's when they did the brick job in the fall of 1909. The outer lip in the turns was probably 20, 23, 24 degrees, quite a bit steeper. And I forget what the width was now, but I think it was like 12 feet or something like that. And the idea was that you would go into the turn, if you overcooked a turn, that you could go up the banking and then diamond back down. Mm-hmm. Well, they had an outer wall, which Fisher put in, and apparently in quite plain terms said to Johnny Aiken, one of the drivers who was testing, well, that'll keep you boys inside the park or something like that. Well, it became an issue. It was no longer a retainer, but when you got into the late 20s and early 30s and the speeds were going up faster than they had thought, you know, 20 years earlier, cars would go up the bank and then they would hit the wall, which, and I should have mentioned this, the retaining wall was not at a 90 degree angle to the angle of the banking. It was at a 90 degree angle to the ground. Mm-hmm. And so they would go up and hit the wall and get launched over the top.
Kind of like a ramp.
Just like a ramp. So there's film, and it's recorded, but it's also on film. Late 20s, early 30s, people would hit the wall and go over the top. And so Eddie Rickenbacker took over the track in 27, and safety was an issue with him, even during the Depression when they had no money, but he decided we need to spend this anyway. And so one of the things that they did was to take out that outer lip. But then also they put in a second wall. They didn't take out the wall that was there. They put another one in front of it that was at a 90 degree angle to the angle of the track. And that was still there until 1992, the summer of 92. And then they actually took all of the wall out and put a new one in. But prior to that, The two original walls were still there, and I'm probably going on too long here, but at the whatever the opposite of the apex of the turn, if you went to the apex of the turn and then walked up to the top of the wall, you actually had two walls with concrete was poured down into like the wedge. And I'm sure that, because I've been asked about this numerous times, and I know that many people that sat, if you sat in turns 1, 2, 3, or 4, you could go down to the wall and see that there was actually two walls. So the fall 1909 wall was still there until 1992. Yeah. And then when they replaced it with the wall that's there now, it's more of a history lesson than you wanted. Some of that wall that was taken out went into the lake that is on Holman. When you go down Holman, when the golf course was redone, mm-hmm. and there's hills where there didn't used to be hills and lakes where there didn't used to be lakes, if you look in that lake, a lot of that masonry in there is actually the 1909 wall that came out.
All right. Thank you for calling to get us started on that topic, Joe. We'll continue with more of your thoughts at 239-1070. Questions for Donald Davidson of a historical nature concerning the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5, 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee, along with Donald Davidson, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Back to your telephone calls coming up in a moment at 239-1070. Unfortunate part of the program, but when we do lose someone, we like to pay our respects, and people are always curious and learning a little bit more. Let's start with the person that I'm most familiar with, a friend of mine, Gary Lee, longtime motorsports broadcaster who passed away unexpectedly last week.
Unexpectedly? That was a real surprise.
Yep, I had not talked to Gary for maybe a year or so, but I know people that had talked to him a week before.
Yeah. In fact, I know people that talked to him over that weekend. Yeah. He was at Winchester the week before because there was, I believe, some kind of a plaque to mark it as a historical place took place, and that would be 2 weeks ago now, I think. And then the week after that, which was a week ago, there was a car show locally. I'm not sure where that was, but apparently he was at that as well. Mm-hmm. And I think displayed a vehicle because he had an old fire truck, which he would take from time to time. But I was trying to remember the last time that I talked to him, and it might have been the spring, but it doesn't seem very long ago because I talked to him a lot. And so I've thought a great deal about him and very sad, continue to be. I don't remember first meeting him. And with a lot of people, I do recall the first time I ever met them. Him, I do not, but it had to have been around 70, 71. And it seems to me that all of a sudden he was on the scene doing a lot of PA at short tracks. And it just seemed that for a while there, he had all of the tracks. And then I remember that he was on the PA in 1977 because there was a Clay Regazzoni had a crash in qualification, which Gary called. I do recall that. And I think he might have only been on there a year or two. And then of course, the heyday of Thunder, or ESPN, I should say, before they even had Thunder, I think that started in 1980 with Bob Jenkins and Larry Neuber. And then it wasn't long before Gary was the third one. And then later on, Thunder, whether it was Thursday night or Saturday night, mm-hmm. it kept changing with Larry Rice. And my personal dealings with Gary, probably from about the mid 70s, I suppose. And we did the USAC banquet. We co-emceed several times. And then about as much fun as I've ever had in broadcasting as a non-professional was the qualification highlights on Channel 4, which we did for 6 years, 84 through 89, which is 5 years, but six seasons. Mm-hmm. And those were the thoroughly enjoyable shows to do. And it was Gary's choice that I join him because typically you would have a driver expert. And when they talked about doing the show, because everybody else was doing one, he said, no, I don't. Let's not do a driver. Let's have Donald. And so I would do my stuff at the track and talk of Gasoline Alley was over at 7, and I would go home and get a jacket and then drive down to Channel 4 on Bluff Road, and I would get there at probably 8:30, and 9 o'clock was air, and I think we went live sometimes and taped others, but anyway, the point was we had no script, just a running order, and a lot of features that in those days, 84, 85, 86, there was still a lot of sprint car type involvement with chassis and Vogler and the local teams and Galen Fox. And there was a lot of local short track type of involvement with the participants. And so we would do all of those things, and we'd do run by run, and all of it was ad libs, and we would go to the we'd have a quick run through on what the running order was and what feature material they had, and then Gary and I would go to the restroom, and we would put the ties on, and then we would straighten each other's ties, and basically he'd say, all right, well look, you got anything you want to talk about, or why don't you you introduce the George Snyder piece, and I'll do the Gary Bettenhausen piece. And then when we'd come back to the track the next day, it seemed like everybody had watched it. And a huge compliment that I got was the late Tom Keating with the Indianapolis Star. And he was huge into all sports. And he called one day and he said, I really love that show that you and Gary do. And he said, it's so different from all of the others. And he said, I try to catch them all. But he said, it seems like you guys cover everything, and every question that I have, you answer at some point, and you do all of these neat little features. And he said, it seems like that the other three, the three network affiliates, it's a half-hour program. The first half is talking about Newman, Haas, and Penske, and then the second half is the driver expert justifying why he hasn't qualified for the show yet. But anyway, they were so much fun to work. And then in 1995, Channel 23, for 3 years, they did a lot of coverage, including a three-hour block every day from 11 o'clock to 2, which people said, you'll never be able to fill the time. And we did. And in 95, it was Gary. And basically, we sat on director's chairs in the pit area, and we did a three-hour radio talk show on television. And we had all kinds of guests, but it was just so much fun to work with him. And then, the radio network and some very memorable calls. And personally,
I remember Roberto Guerrero on the pace laps. I think he...
Oh, was that...
No, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of...
It was the 92 finish.
I was thinking of... Who else was it? Someone that had crashed on the pace lap.
Sneaver in 86 did that.
Eh.
But Gary's part of the Scott Goodyear Little Al finish with... keep those cameras handy.
It
could be a photo finish or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. That is what he said.
But and then a little later on, maybe 3 years ago or a couple of years ago, he was involved with a three-quarter midget group that ran at Shelbyville with that wonderful old grandstand that somebody burned down that was built by people that had been in the Civil War. This wonderful, wonderful grandstand. And if that person ever gets revealed, they better not reveal themselves to some of us, because we may not treat them, but we might even boo. But anyway, Gary did the PA for that and invited me down to be his guest. And then there was a banquet where... he said, I can for the kids. He said, we'll get some people together. And he had Bob Jenkins and Howdy Bell and Larry Rice and Tony Stewart's mother and myself. And there might have been somebody else. And anyway, we all just had a great time. And I ran on a little long here, but I went on a couple of trips with him and Bob Jenkins. And I really, really enjoyed him. I thought he was excellent on public address. He was a great storyteller. Personally, he beat up on himself a lot. He would get down and some people, you really can't do anything about that. But with him, you could kid him out of it. All you had to do is if you were with him on the phone, it was a little different. But if you were with him, all you had to do is start smiling and he'd say, "What are you smirking about?" then it would lighten him up. But he was a good friend, and I think I've been thinking about him a lot. I miss him greatly, and I think that the short track race fans probably understand this, but I think we all owe Gary Lee a great deal of gratitude for his body of work.
Yep, we will miss Gary Lee. And then yesterday morning, we learned about Jim Garner.
Yeah, you get these... celebrity types that...
we should probably explain for the younger listeners that may not know who Jim Garner was.
Well, James Garner was...
Famous actor, Maverick.
Went from television to films and then back to television. You said it there. There was Maverick was probably what put him on the map. And then the Rockford Files came later after he'd done several films. The Great Escape and Grand Prix are probably the ones that stick out, and then some later ones. But he had a genuine interest in racing, and the first time he came to the track, I think, was 1960. And then he came back for quite a number of years thereafter, and then there was a period when he didn't, but it was because he was working. He was doing the Rockford Files, and his total number of visits to the track was probably 35 times, I'd say. He drove the pace car three times. And anyway, you get these celebs that come in and they say all the right things. And gee, what a thrill it is to be here. I've never had the opportunity to be here before. Well, actually, you have. You had the opportunity every year, but you know, it really wasn't on your, it wasn't in your bucket list. And but he came year after year because he genuinely liked it, and he was a very nice person. Before I met him, I remember being impressed that he did commercials for Kodak. Do you remember those? And Mariette Hartley.
Yeah.
And I remember that there was some kind of a contract dispute involving her, and he thought she was getting the short end of the stick and stuck up for her. So he was sort of like for helping out colleagues, but also sometimes for the lesser lights, if he thought they weren't getting a fair shake, he'd go to bat for them, and a lot of them wouldn't. And so he'd been around for a number of years before I finally did meet him, and then actually interviewed him on the talk of Gasoline Alley in 1985, which he drove the pace car, and that was the last year for the old garage area. And he gave all kinds of inside stuff with great stories about Doris Day and the making of Grand Prix. And I remember one thing that really impressed me was the Japanese fellow who plays the, what it's clearly Honda, but they gave him another name. And it was Tsuri Buffon or something like that. I've got that wrong, and a lot of people will jump on me. But a very well-known Japanese actor. And James Garner told me two things that I thought were eyebrow raising, and one was that Mifune had a piece of the action; he owned part of the film, and the other thing was that he did not speak English, and memorized the part phonetically.
Wow!
Isn't that something? But yeah. Anyway, a lot of other great stuff about you know, the making of the film and some of the other stuff as well.
I've seen it. I'll have to watch that again.
Well,
it's been seven or eight years.
But beyond that, though, he was a genuine racing enthusiast and became very involved. He had a Can-Am team, and Scooter Patrick was the driver. And then he raced in the Baja series and became a very good friend of Parnelli Jones. And they played golf a lot. And apparently he was an excellent golfer, but he would come and he would go to Mary George's party for the 50s and 60s, and he'd go to the fairgrounds when they would run the Hoosier 100, and even when they were running 250-lap sprint races, and he'd be up on the roof there. And he genuinely was a great racing enthusiast. He knew a lot of the drivers on a first-name basis. And I remember one day, and I'm doing long stories here, but I was thinking about this, and I've thought about it a lot. One day, I remember seeing him come down past the old master control tower, heading down for the pace car room on a very hot day, and some fans on the top row of the stands yelled out, and he looked up and waved back and kept on walking. And I thought he looked, you know, very, he was perspiring and you know, looked like he was probably feeling a little bit grimy. And I thought, I wonder if he actually walked from the North End Suites, maybe on the outside, the Holman Terrace Suites. And so I asked him about it later, and he said, oh, yeah. And I said, well, you didn't call somebody to come up and get you on a car? And he said, oh, no, it's all right. I'm an Oklahoma boy. It's not very far. And then I said, I've noticed that very often, you know, you don't have an entourage with you. You don't walk around with 5,000 credentials. You're usually by yourself and just waving at the fans. And he said, well, he said, I always felt that a crowd draws a crowd. And walk along. But I mean, he couldn't be nicer to the friends to the fans, I should say. And I know there's photographs of them where somebody passed a beer through the fence when he was down in turn one to watch the start and so on and so forth. So ill health had kept him away in recent years, but he just was just a very, very nice person. And you know, it's corny to say, but Gary Lee and James Garner, God bless you both, and you'll be missed, and we won't forget you in a hurry.
Just looked it up. His name originally, James Bumgarner.
Yeah, did you know his real name? His brother was a major league pitcher, Played for, because we talked about that a little bit. I mean, he actually talked about his brother, because when I asked him, I said, were you always interested in racing? And he said, well, my brother and I were interested in cars. And as was typically American then, was it Norman, Oklahoma, or somewhere in Oklahoma?
And yes, Norman, Oklahoma.
They would, golly, I did that one for memory. But anyway, when they were kids, like everybody else in those days, they would work on their own cars. So, I mean, you know, they would hop up their Chevy or DeSoto or whatever they had back when kids don't work on cars anymore. But, Jack Baumgartner was his brother. And in fact, you're probably already looking up to see what teams he played for. Lamy knew him.
The Wikipedia page doesn't mention him, so I will look him up on – I have a baseball – statistical side.
Maybe Lamy will call in and he can tell you everything.
I just talked
about
to Bob earlier today.
Did you?
I did. Yeah. All right. So I'll look that up while we. And thank you for the reflections on Jim Garner and Gary Lee.
Thank you, Kevin, for the opportunity.
All right. Jeff in Greensburg, Indiana, is up next with Donald Davidson. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Hi.
Hey, Donald, it's an honor. I was going to ask you about any good Scott Brayton stories because he's one of my favorite drivers of all time.
Okay, there's a little bit of distortion. You're saying Scott Brayton?
But I think he changed up his mind.
Oh.
Go ahead, Jeff.
And it just came to my mind about talking about the safety issues and all that on the track. Did Bill Simpson ever play a big part in safety?
Did Bill Simpson play a great part in safety? Yes. that would be an understatement to... Bill Simpson played a huge role in safety and, in fact, would actually be playing more of a role in other sports like football. He didn't just jump on the bandwagon with the concussion issue in football, because he was actually developed a football helmet. I don't know, Kevin, if you know anything about this, but I mean, this had to be like 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yeah, and he's still trying to get more to use it, but this is a continuing process.
Well, I know that he was working on it one time.
Getting some ground.
There was resistance from the NFL because he said, I've got this helmet, which I think is better than what the fellows were using. But anyway, no, Bill Simpson was huge on safety, and that goes all the way back with uniforms. And, golly, not being a gearhead, I couldn't address everything, but with Simpson safety equipment and then later with Impact, huge advancement in safety and just driver protection in general. And it would go into other sports. So if the call is still there, did you still want me to talk about Scott Brayton?
Yeah, if you would, Donald. Any good stories?
Okay. Scotty had a... I'm going to probably cut to the chase here. Well, the best finish that he had was 6th, which was 1989 and 1993. But beyond everything was he had an extraordinary knowledge of the sport. He was very interested in the history of racing, way more than most drivers that you run into. And he always was wanting to know, you know, where he stood, like in the all-time standings and all the different categories. And he won the pole in 1995 for Menard, and then he came back and won it again in 1986 to win back-to-back poles. Now, he knew that nobody'd ever won the pole 3 years in a row, and that was his ambition. And not only that, but I think there were 8 others. I haven't thought about this for a while. There were 8 others that had won back-to-back poles, or maybe it was 6. Anyway, he could name the others, and that was Ralph De Palmer and Rex Mays and Mario and Foyt and Eddie Sachs and Parnelli Jones, and maybe I've got them all. But anyway, he could run through the whole lot. And... I don't know if there's been a more enthusiastic driver ever. Certainly the among the most enthusiastic and inspiring drivers. And even John Menard said what a delight it was to work with Scott Brayton, because he would call up at 3 o'clock in the morning with some great idea for setup. And the 1996, probably the biggest crapshoot I think I've ever seen at the track, because now we hear about withdrawing your time and going again seems to be commonplace because the rules have sort of encouraged that more. But in 1996, he'd qualified for the outside of the second row and decided we can go for the pole, and withdrew the car that had earned the outside second row position temporarily and went out with a backup car and won the pole. And I thought, Scott Brayton, don't forget why you came here. You could lose everything because if you have an accident or have a problem with this car, then, you're out of the show because you irrevocably withdrew the time that you had. But he came back and won the pole, and what a fabulous story that was. And then tragically, I think 4 days later, when he was running fuel tests with a backup car and then had the accident and just a terrible tragedy. It seemed that the IRL in those days was getting beaten up left, right, and center because all of the guys that really would have been the IRL, poster people were getting hurt. And the loss of Scott Brayton was just huge. So anyway, we've done, three obituaries in a row here. And but anyway, we thank you. We think about Scotty quite a lot. He was great. Great fun to be around.
All right, I've looked up and tried to find Jack Garner.
Jack Baumgartner.
Well, either...
Did he go by Garner?
He apparently went by Garner.
I didn't know that.
But there is no Jack Baumgartner that ever pitched in the major leagues. There's a Madison Baumgartner, who is a current pitcher, a good pitcher for the San Francisco Giants. There is no Jack Garner that ever pitched in the major leagues. But he apparently, Jim Garner's brother, Jack, was also an actor and does have a Wikipedia page, and it says that he pitched in the minor leagues in the Pirates organization for 11 years. So he was a pitcher, a professional pitcher, just apparently did not make the major leagues.
I thought he'd gone
in
to
in a regular season. All these stories happen all the time.
You got a phone? You got a number for Lamy? Let's get Lamy on the phone.
He apparently did not, according to baseballreference.com, which is a very reputable site that has a record of anyone that's ever played in the major leagues. Either Jack Garner or Jack Baumgartner does not appear. This says he played as a minor league pitcher for an affiliate with the Pittsburgh Pirates for 11 years. And later, I don't know what his name was at the time, but he eventually went by Jack Garner.
I've been wrong all these years.
Well, you know what? He's an actor who was in the Rockford Files. So apparently Jim got him a job in his own TV show.
I know he did that for other people because I remember he died three
years ago.
Late in the Move Over, Darling. Schneider on One Day at a Time. I can't think of his name now. Oh my goodness. Anyway, he was I think like the district attorney in the late minutes of Move Over, Darling, and he said he got in the job. Golly, come on, trivia people.
He did several television shows in the 60s. He was also in the movie Maverick with his brother in 1994 and a few other
Pat Harrington Jr. Pat Harrington Jr. was the guy that was a friend of his. And he said, I used to play golf with him and I got him the job on the show.
Well, so there we go. That's what we know about that. We've gone over time. But we'll do it again tomorrow night.
That's all right. The Pacers owe us one.
All right. Thanks to Donald for being here tonight. Thanks to David Deering. Is there a podcast for this? Yes. It will be up in a little bit, so spread the word. Not on iTunes, but available by going directly to 1070thefan.com, and you can download it there with a couple of clicks. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow night at 7 for Trackside, then Donald at 8 o'clock here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.